Helen, please. Oops.
Good morning, Your Honors. I just had flashbacks to when I took that oath, and it was probably when some of these people were not yet in elementary schools. Your Honor, it's a pleasure to be before the court again. I am presuming that we will have no questions about Venn diagrams, but if we do, I will certainly try and answer them as best as I can. Your Honors, as the court knows, we're here to argue three arguments. I, along with Lieutenant Kara Condit, represent Petty Officer Leader. In the first of those issues, the military judge erred in denying the defense motion to dismiss the charges for a violation of the appellant's right to a speedy trial under RCM 7.
Oh, one second. Can you hear in the back? Marginal, a little louder, just like yesterday.
The problem is yesterday, Judge. I'm sorry. As the court knows, the standard of review for a speedy trial is de novo. Under RCM 707, the government must bring the appellant to trial within 120 days of the earlier of referral of charges or the imposition of pretrial restraint. That is RCM 707A. The sole remedy for a violation of RCM 707 is dismissal of the affected charges. And I'll discuss in a minute the different standard between dismissal with or without prejudice. And as the court also knows, the withdrawal of charges and the dismissal of charges have very distinct effects on the 707 clock. A dismissal of charges resets the 707 clock. A new 120-day period begins upon the earlier of either re-referral of charges or re-imposition of pretrial restraint. The charges should be dismissed according to RCM 401C1 when they fail to state an offense, are unsupported by available evidence, or for some other sound reason warranting dismissal.
Now, your argument, it seems to be predicated on the fact that the discussion illustrations that you've just cited to represent the sum total of the reasons that it is proper to dismiss. Is that your position?
No, Judge, and it's because the language some other reason could not be an all-inclusive reason.
Can the some other reason be a desire on the part of the convening authority to present all charges at a single court-martial?
If it is pre-arraignment, but not once it is post-arraignment. A dismissal contemplates that the appellant no longer faces charges, that conditions on liberty and pretrial restraint are lifted, and he is returned to full-time duty with full rights as accorded to all others.
That's out of Britain. Is that in the rule itself?
No, that is out of Britain.
So, and it's an inference or an implication in your view of Britain, not necessarily the holding in Britain. Is that correct? Is that fair to say?
Actually, Judge,
I mean, was Britain addressing this specific issue?
No.
Okay.
But that is certainly the way that we read Britain. And, Judge, I think the best way that the court can look at this is this. When charges are dismissed, you can't join something that does not exist. When something is withdrawn, you can join something that has been withdrawn. Therefore, when the convening authority purported to join the new charges, you can only do that to charges that are withdrawn, not charges that are dismissed. And again, according to Britain, if the convening authority wants to pursue previously dismissed charges, he must re-refer, investigate, and re-refer, as though there were no previous charges or proceedings. And that is the key to the holding in Britain. A withdrawal of charges, on the other hand, can be done at any time before findings are announced. That's under RCM 604-alpha. The charges are still viable and may be re-referred without re-referral and reinvestigation. That, again, is from Bellotto. Withdrawn charges must be dismissed unless it is intended to refer them anew promptly or refer them to another authority or disposition, RCM 604-alpha. Withdrawal does not automatically result in a dismissal absent further action by the convening authority. That's the Tippett case from this court. Finally, it can be referred to another court-martial by the convening authority unless the convening authority withdrew for an improper reason. And most importantly, as per Britain, withdrawal does not stop or reset the 707 clock. When you look at all of these things taken together, Your Honors, if it looks like a withdrawal, if it sounds like a withdrawal, and it acts like a withdrawal, it is a withdrawal of charges, no matter what language the convening authority puts on it. The convening authority's action was a withdrawal of charges and not a dismissal. And
when the charges were ultimately brought, tried, were they tried before the same court-martial or a different court-martial?
Judge, I actually don't know the answer to that off the top of my brain. I'll certainly get it to you.
Would that be relevant?
I don't believe it would be. The terminology, and again, this is both Tippett and Britton, the terminology that the convening authority uses is not determinative. You must look at the facts and the circumstances to determine intent.
Is this a case where, in your view, the convening authority emphatically dismissed it, withdrew the charges? We're not really sure whether he withdrew and dismissed them, and it's ambiguous, and now we try to figure it out, or it's unambiguous that he dismissed the charges?
Oh, I think it's clear. It's very ambiguous what the convening authority... I think what he did, what he intended...
Now, do you mind doing the checklist as to, on the one hand, on the other hand, what makes it, if we take it as a start point that it's ambiguous, what indicates that he, in fact, dismissed the charges, and what indicates that he, in fact, merely withdrew them?
Well, I think the only thing that indicates that he dismissed them is the language where he says he dismissed them. What indicates that he withdrew them is the fact that they did not do a new 32, the fact that they did not lift the imposition of pretrial restraint, the fact that there's one other judge, and it's just skipping my brain, and it'll come to me in just a second.
These are the Britton things, the Britton factors?
That's correct, Judge. And all of those factors weigh in favor of the fact that this was a withdrawal of charges, contrary to the convening authority's somewhat ambiguous language. Because once again, you can't add something to something that doesn't exist. So when the convening authority says that he is adding charges to the previous charges, if the previous charges have been dismissed, then that is obviously a non sequitur. The convening authority stated that in anticipation of the possibility of the new litigation and in the interest of judicial economy, while the language states that the language clearly and unambiguously states, and I believe, Judge, this is the answer to the other one that I was coming up looking for, that he does not intend for the appellant to face new charges, or does intend, rather, for the appellant to face new charges. The letter does not say that he intends to do away with the charges or dismiss them for any period of time. The length of time between the convening authority's letter and restitution of the charges was extremely short, just as in United States versus Britton, in this case, one working day, 4 days, including a 3-day weekend. Britton was the same working day. The appellant remained under the same restrictions and did not experience a momentary return to full duty status. The proceedings employed by the government, in addition to the action taken by the convening authority, are consistent with a withdrawal. The old charges were never reinvestigated, and the Article 32 investigation only covered the new charge. The charges in this case should be dismissed because the government violated RCM 707 by failing to bring the appellant to trial within 120 days. Withdrawal after arraignment does not stop the speedy trial clock. That is the Britton case. So if one looks at the calendar in this case, the appellant was arraigned on 7 July 2011. The charges were withdrawn on 1 September 2011. The appellant was rearranged on 8 November 2011, and he was brought to trial, exclusive of defense delay, 160 days after referral of the original charges. The charges should be dismissed in this case with prejudice. As the court knows, under RCM 707 Delta, dismissal is the sole remedy. And the factors to determine whether the charges should be dismissed with or without prejudice are as follows: the seriousness of the offense, the facts and circumstances that led to the dismissal, the impact of a re-prosecution on the administration of justice, and any prejudice to the appellant resulting from the denial of a speedy trial. RCM doesn't, the 707 does not prioritize whether they, how to sort of group that list. It is simply a case of the court's broad discretion. And as you look at those factors in the instant case, the appellant would argue as follows. While the charges are certainly serious, they're serious in every general court-martial. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Article 32s for general court-martials. But that simply cannot trump the speedy trial rights of the appellant. The facts and the circumstances surrounding it is obviously the government wanted to, the proper reason was to add the additional charge to serve the interest of justice or promote judicial economy. But this is not what happened in this case. The only reason why we even had to go through this dance is because the government investigators failed to adequately interview one of their own witnesses very early on in the trial process. And the real reason, the underlying reason why the government wanted to...
Very early on, you mean August 9th?
No, I mean, I forget when the first interview of the witness was, but it was prior to the Article 32 in this case. I don't remember the exact date.
But you're talking about the discovery of LS as a potential victim?
The discovery came much later. but the initial interview of that witness was before the initial Article 32 investigation.
Oh, I see. So you're saying they should have interviewed her earlier, at which point they would have discovered what they discovered on August 9th?
In fact, yes. In fact, Judge, they interviewed the witness who they got that information from. That witness was a, I believe last name was Patterson, I could be wrong, but that witness was a witness at the original Article 32 investigation.
Do you have any evidence that they were not diligent in going about interviewing this witness?
Well, they did interview the witness. They interviewed him, the person who led them on to.
But your argument seems to be that they weren't diligent in doing so.
Well, I would think, yes.
What in the record is evidence of that?
Well, Judge, I think it's just a clear inference to make that when they were able to interview this person later and get this information, if they had done a more thorough interview earlier, they would have gotten that information. And finally, Judge, one must look to the prejudice to the appellant as a result of the delay, and this must be done on a case-by-case basis. As the court knows, the appellant had serious restrictions imposed on his liberty. He was reassigned while awaiting court-martial. He was not permitted to work in his rating. He was not permitted to supervise junior personnel, and by his own testimony, suffered both physical and emotional stress. In assignment of error two, the government's withdrawal of charges, and obviously these two assignments of error are closely married to that.
Well, if in fact we decide it's withdrawn, do we need to get to two?
You do not need to get to two.
I didn't think so.
No, sir.
Okay.
But since this court has on occasion in my years of before it disagreed with me, I figured I would go ahead and do assignment of error two anyway. The government's withdrawal of charges and referral to another court-martial was in violation of RCM 604 Bravo because they were previously withdrawn for an improper reason. Under RCM 604, the convening authority may withdraw for any reason prior to announcement of the findings. The previously withdrawn charges can be referred to another court-martial unless the withdrawal was for an improper reason, and the government must articulate good cause for withdrawal and re-referral. The government bears the burden of showing by a preponderance of the evidence that withdrawal and re-referral were not done for an improper purpose. And Judge, this goes along with the Chief Judge with the discussion we were having earlier as to the exhaustive or inexhaustive list. While there is a list of proper reasons, including legitimate command reasons under U.S. v. Underwood and under 604 Bravo, steps by receipt of additional charges.
Why isn't this receipt of additional charges?
Well, that is one of the possible legitimate reasons, but that is, again, pre-arraignment. It is not post-arraignment.
What's the basis for that assertion?
I think it's in the rule, Judge, but I will certainly double-check.
Okay.
But then the court, RCM 604 Bravo, talks about legitimate reasons after arraignment, and all it says is some circumstances. It says basically literally that there are some circumstances.
Couldn't judicial economy be some circumstances?
Well, one would think if it were, Judge, that it would be one of the delineated reasons. It is not.
Although the court the manual and rules state, I don't know, repeatedly, but at least two times that the preference is to try all charges at one court-martial.
That is certainly a preference, but if it were
so, it's hard to turn around and say that's an improper reason when the court-martial the manual keeps on telling you to do it that way.
Well, Judge, I think there's a couple of ways that we need to look at that. One of those is it is obviously not, and you know, not something that should never happen, or there would not be rules on sevens. In addition, In the instant case, one has to remember that the Article 32 investigating officer of the sole additional charge recommended dismissal of that charge. And while that recommendation is certainly not binding, it is something that this court should consider in determining whether or not it was a proper purpose.
But that was after this occurred, was it not?
After what occurred?
After the withdrawal slash dismissal slash whatever it is?
Yes, correct, Judge.
So the CA did not act with the knowledge that the IO had recommended the charges not proceed.
He, not at the time that he withdrew, dismissed, or did whatever to the charges. Certainly at the time that he, quote, combined or joined the new charge to the pre-existing charges. He obviously had knowledge.
But you're here contesting not that, but contesting the withdrawal slash dismissal, whatever it was.
Right. Judge, Your Honors, in my closing minute, there was no legitimate reason for withdrawal of the charges in this case. The stated reason, the receipt of additional charges, was, in the appellant's view, simply a subterfuge to wanting to bring all the charges to a single court-martial, or rather, for wanting to stop the speedy trial clock. There was no reason whatsoever to not simply run two court martials or to do what the IO and the second charge recommended, which was to either dismiss or dispose of the second charge through non-judicial punishment. In this case, judicial economy was simply not a good enough reason when the additional charge was to an unrelated matter to the original charges. It occurred 6 months before the original charges were preferred. It was belatedly discovered due to the government's failure to properly investigate, and the investigating officer, or the evidence supporting the new charge was extremely weak, leading the investigating officer to recommend dismissal. Based on, or subject to any further members, questions from members of the court, that precludes my presentation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
You all time on rebuttal. Counsel for the government, please.
May it please the court, I am Lieutenant Commander Lee, and I represent the United States in this matter. The Gaming Authority issued a clear order to withdraw and dismiss the charges in Lear 1, and every action that he took after doing so, and that the trial counsel did after he ordered.
Well, an order to withdraw and dismiss is about as clear as mud, because they're two different things. Which one was he doing?
Well, sir, they were referred to a court-martial, so he's withdrawing it from that court-martial and then dismissing, sir. Two-part process. He could obviously have withdrawn and re-referred to a different court-martial, or he could withdraw from the general court-martial and dismiss, which is what he did, sir. He ordered the trial counsel to cross out the charges and write that they were withdrawn and dismissed. He ordered the trial counsel to notify the accused that he was no longer facing charges. And then, after the dismissal was executed, he took legitimate steps as required under the rules to prefer those charges.
Does a charge have to be withdrawn before it can be dismissed?
Well, sir, if it's at a general court-martial, or any court-martial, sir, it would be proper to withdraw it and then dismiss it, sir. I mean, it could be a simultaneous withdrawal and dismissal to pull it back and then dismiss, sir. But
is there anywhere in the rules or the UCMJ that says that a withdrawal is required before a dismissal can be made?
No, sir, but I think it could be read into it because they're at the court-martial and they can be pulled back, and then any number of things could be done with them.
So if the convening authority here just dismissed, that would have been improper?
No, sir, I think that would have been also proper as well, sir. But the key word is that he dismissed and then lined out the charges and then treated them as if they were no longer charges. He preferred a neutral accuser preferred anew, and then the charges were then referred to a new court-martial.
I'm confused by something in your brief. You say, or I don't know if you wrote your brief, but
yes, sir.
The government's brief.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Page 5, here the convening authority contemplated that appellant would face charges in the future, but he did not intend that he face them on the date of the dismissal. But he says in the 1-4th paragraph, reason to withdraw the charge from a court-martial with the intent of re-referring them to a different court-martial.
Yes, sir. He did not. What I mean by that, sir, and I did write the brief, is that on the date 1 September, there were no charges because he ordered the trial counsel to cross them off. Now, he always in his mind contemplated that the accused would face other charges. That was...
So it's the same charges, right, plus one?
Yes, sir.
Okay, not other charges.
Well, I say other, sir, because the old charges were crossed out and therefore...
Well, yeah, but you got the same charges.
For the same
misconduct. Plus one.
Yes, sir, for the same misconduct plus
one. For the same misconduct. Over a long weekend, was it?
It was from the 1st to the 6th, sir, so 5 days. It was Labor Day weekend that year, yes, sir.
Okay, it was late. So you had an intervening long weekend. He does whatever. He does his ambiguous action on 1 September with the notion of recharging the guy.
Yes, sir.
And over a long weekend, whatever happened. And then suddenly, like Athena out of the head of Zeus, here are the new charges.
Yes,
but they're the same old charges.
Yes, sir. But as this court has held in United States versus Bellotto, the fact that he intended that charges be preferred anew does not negate an otherwise clear dismissal. And in this case, because...
Right. Well, but it's not a clear dismissal. It's an ambiguous action, and we have to evaluate it by the facts. And the facts seem to point to withdrawal. So where are we?
Sir, it's the United States' position that it is a clear dismissal because of the action of lining it out, notifying the accused that charges no longer exist.
Well, did they take the accused? Did they take the restrictions off the accused?
No, so the condition,
no, they didn't.
There was conditions on liberty, sir. It was not pretrial restrictions.
No, I know that. I know that. But there were conditions on his liberty that were not removed.
Yes,
right?
Sir. The military judge found, sir, in May's findings of fact in the record, that those conditions on liberty pertain to the second charge, the Coast Guard petty officer, the new victim, sir.
Why were the conditions on liberty imposed earlier when there was no second charge?
Sir, because there was a concern about the accused or the appellant seeking retribution against the witness.
Well, now I'm totally confused.
Yes, sir.
They were imposed in the first place for one reason.
Yes, sir.
And then they were kept on for another reason.
Yes, sir. Well, they were imposed for the first reason, sir, because of the fear that the victim would be harmed by the appellant.
Okay.
When the charges were dismissed, sir,
there's no charge that would presumably provoke him to, you know, harm ahead.
Yes, sir. Prior to the dismissal of charges, the new victim came forward, and she was stationed with the appellant at the same small command in Mobile, Alabama, sir. So they determined, and the command has determined, and it's found in the record at 134 and 135 of the joint appendix, that he needed to be transferred to a new unit to remove him from both the witnesses and the new alleged victim,
okay,
the Coast Guard petty officer. And the military judge found that to be the reason for the conditions on liberty existing during the dismissal period from 1 to 6 September. But even if this court does not find that was the reason...
Well, it's one thing to move him around, and it's another thing to restrict his liberty.
Yes, sir. He had call-in duty, essentially, sir. He had to call in from the landline, so they knew where he was.
But your essential point, if it may be correct or incorrect, or clearly erroneous or not clearly erroneous, but the government's position is that the second round of restriction, whatever it was the result of LS, not the result of BM. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. But even if this court disagrees with that, sir, United States versus Anderson, which postdates Britain by 11 years and is from this court, found that continuing pretrial restriction or pretrial confinement does not necessarily mean that the charges were not dismissed. In Anderson, the accused was charged with indecent acts and placed in pretrial restriction. The child victim in that case then raised a claim of sodomy as well, and the government took a step back and said, we need to investigate. So they dismissed the charge, but the pretrial restriction continued for the entire time that the Anderson charges were dismissed and then re-preferred and referred anew.
Can I bring you back to page 5 again?
Yes, sir.
The brief makes the point that the convening authority did not intend that the appellant face the charges on the date of the dismissal.
Yes, sir.
Is that important? The implication of that sentence is that if he did intend that the appellant face those same charges on the date of the dismissal, he could not do that.
Yes, sir. I guess I...
Is it the government's position that you can dismiss a charge knowing full well that you intend to bring the charge anew a week later?
Yes, sir. And that's the holding United States versus Bellotto, which was a lower court opinion, sir, but affirmed summarily by this court, and that was the holding of Bellotto.
The brief just is gathering up random facts, and this is not a material fact that is put in here?
The fact that he...
He did not intend that he faced them on the date of the dismissal.
Sir, for a dismissal to be effective, the charges have to no longer exist, and what I was...
Right, which is different than saying no longer exist, but you can intend that they exist in a few days.
Yes, sir, and I apparently inartfully said that, sir. Would I intend?
I'm not trying to make you confess that your brief could have been clearer, but I'm making sure that this is not an essential point.
No, sir, it's...
But what is the essential point is what I'm getting at.
Sir, it certainly could have been clearer, and my intention in writing that, sir, was to say the charges were dismissed. They didn't exist, but he did anticipate that the same misconduct would be charged at a later date.
Counsel, yes, is there anything else that the government could have done to add an additional charge at this point to the same court-martial without withdrawing and dismissing them?
Well, ma'am, they could have added it. It was post-agreement, ma'am, added it and sought the consent of the accused to do so, Your Honor. But they chose not to do that and instead dismissed and started anew. And the purpose behind the Joint Rule 601 Echo 2, Your Honor, that says that no post-arraignment charges can be added without consent, is...
Well, and they did still do it in another Article 32, correct?
Yes, ma'am. And they did the 32 for the second judicial charge, ma'am.
And it that point in time, was there any objection by the accused to the procedures that the government was following?
There was no objection with respect to 32, ma'am, no. They did not object to the fact that the government did not do a new Article 32 proceeding. And, of course, under Article 32 Charlie, the government is permitted to use an old 32 that was, or any investigation that took place prior to the preferral of charges, and use it for charges that had been preferred. And that's what the government did in this case, and the defense did not object.
What day of the clock was it that the charges were withdrawn?
Oh, the clock had been stopped, ma'am. He had been arraigned. And
no, let me ask in a different way.
Okay.
On what day was he arraigned?
He was arraigned, ma'am, in the first set of charges on the 7th of July, ma'am.
No, but what day on the clock was that?
Oh, ma'am, it was at, excluding defense delay, ma'am, it was on day 75.
So well within 100
yes,
days?
Ma'am.
Is
yes,
that
ma'am.
Relevant?
I think it is relevant to show the good faith on the part of the government here. They were not taking this action to suppress an exercise of the appellant's rights or to deny him a constitutional right to a speedy trial or any other statutory right. They were doing this because they believed that the purpose of judicial economy was a valid reason to add a charge post-arraignment, as this court found in United States versus Coke.
Does good faith on the part of the government matter if they bust the clock? Don't we have to dismiss?
Yes, sir. But
okay, yeah.
But with respect,
so good faith only matters if the clock's not busted.
Yes, sir. But
okay.
With respect to their actions, sir, I think it's important to look at the fact that they were complying with the rules and dismissing the charge and preferring it anew. And they weren't doing so because they were at 119 on their clock, sir, because they'd already busted the clock, or that they wanted a new military judge, or that there was an exclusion of evidence that they were trying to get around. This was the only Coast Guard trial judge. This was the same judge they were going to get again for general courts martial. And my apologies. It's the only general court martial judge. They knew exactly what
is that why they're in Norfolk?
The judge actually was in D.C. at the time, sir. He's actually was here, sir.
Okay, the trial was here?
No, so the trial was in Norfolk, sir. I apologize.
Okay.
The military judge was coming down from D.C., sir.
And he's in, all the witnesses and all the actors are in Mobile?
Yes, sir. Not all of them, sir, but several of the victims traveled from Idaho, sir. That was where the original victim resided, and as well as her ex-husband, sir, who testified as well. And some of them came up from Mobile.
Does the record reflect why it's in Norfolk, then, rather than some other place?
They actually litigated that, sir. The military judge wanted it to be in Norfolk. I'm sorry, in Alabama, sir, in Mobile or in New Orleans as well, sir. And the military judge the convening authority said, I know I want it in Norfolk, and they actually litigated that, sir, and they did file with the CCA, the Coast Guard Court, and then the military judge found the purpose of the trial being in Norfolk is proper, that is where the convening authority wants it, and he said it would be judicially economical to have the trial there and to add the additional charge. He said that was valid.
This is to convenience the judge, or what's the reason? Why is the CA wanted it in Norfolk?
Sir, I'm not sure why he wanted Norfolk, sir.
That's not in the record.
I don't think that's clear, no, sir. But it is a fact that all of the defense counsel would have to travel, sir. One was from Miami, and the Navy defense counsel sat first chair. They had to come from Washington, sir, from Bremerton. So there was a lot of traveling by the parties.
Does the record reflect why it took 84 days from the re-preferral to the trial?
Well, sir, they had a new Article 32 investigation, sir, for the additional charge. And then there was a period of time where they were contemplating what to do with the charges, sir. And if you look at the
What do you mean by that, a period of time they were contemplating what to do with the charge?
Well, sir, the convening authority received a memorandum from the defense counsel that it was about a 5-page memorandum, sir, that complained about excessive charging. He essentially said the prosecutors were overreaching in this case because they had charged some very serious misconduct. They had actually charged premeditated murder at one point for the strangulation of the victim. And they ended up reducing that to assault consummated by battery. But there was an additional...
Which presumably was why they put him on restriction.
Presumably, sir.
And then that charge was dismissed.
But, sir, the victim was in Idaho, and they were worried about him going out to get her because of the fact that she had complained to the local police and then it had gone to Coast Guard Investigative Services, sir. But with respect to the defense counsel's request, they were actually looking to reduce another charge from assault with intent to cause grievous bodily injury to assault consummated by a battery. This had to do with when he pulled the victim out of the car and her head hit the curb. And the community authority considered that memorandum from the defense counsel, and he did in fact refer a lesser charge than he had referred in layer one. He referred just the assault consummated by a battery. So he took that time to look at the case anew, to put a fresh light on it, and to actually take the I won't say the advice, the recommendation of the defense counsel that he look at the seriousness of the charges and determine if they were proper. And he did that. And then he referred up a lesser included charge in that respect and the additional charge, and then the remaining charges, the charges from layer one. In doing that, again, his intent was judicial economy, which this court found to be a valid reason in Koch. And Koch is good law, and there is no reason to disturb it. In Koch, they had a situation where all the charges were there was post-arraignment, they were the day before trial, and the military judge found that the 32 was defective with respect to one charge. So he said, I'm inclined to dismiss, to dismiss this charge because the 32 is defective. In that case, the government wanted to keep the charges together and for the purpose of judicial economy. They wanted to try both charges against the accused at one trial. So they withdrew the charges, fixed the 32, and then referred them back to the court-martial. And some amount of time passed between while that happened. It was a matter of days. And this court looked at that and said, that's a valid reason. Judicial economy is a valid reason to withdraw a charge post-arraignment and to fix the problems with the case and then send it back up. And, of course, this court in United States versus Jackson, which is cited in the military judge's order at Joint Appendix 217, Jackson states that the receipt of additional charges after referral is one reason to withdraw and refer to a new court martial. In that case, there was an additional charge that was found. It was post-referral. They pulled it back. They said, we need to take another look at this, and they sent it up. In this case, the government was acting in good faith when they dismissed the charge. And with respect to the dismissal, I would distinguish this case from Britain with respect to the temporal component. In Britain, the withdrawal happened on the same day that the charge was referred anew. But in Britain, the facts are very different from this case. In Britain, there was never a dismissal of the affected charge. The convening authority never said, I'm dismissing this charge. He said, I'm withdrawing it. And only after he did that, and then it came up on appeal, and the government realized, well, if it's a withdrawal and not a dismissal, we busted our 120 clock, then they started calling it a dismissal. But that is clear in Britain, that the convening authority never called it a dismissal.
What is the protection for an appellant in the government's view, or an accused, I should say, in the government's view? How do they protect their 601 right to consent post-arraignment to the joinder of additional charges if, in the government's view, the government can dismiss the charges at any time after arraignment and re-refer them?
Sir.
Albeit for judicial economy, we'll stipulate for a proper reason. What protects what preserves the 601 right?
So we look at 601 and look at the purpose behind it, and as this court said in the United States versus Hayward, which is cited in the appellant's brief, the purpose of that rule is to provide a certain stability to the process and to firm matters against which the accused must defend. But when the government dismisses the charge and starts all over and says, these are dismissed, we're going to go right back to square one, his rights are still protected, because then he knows when he gets to the new arraignment, these are the matters and they're firm. But as long as the government has gone back to square one, if you will.
It's the square one that protects him, because he then goes through all the stuff again.
Yes, sir, and he has an opportunity, as in this case.
What stuff did they go through again in this case?
In this case, sir, they found a neutral accuser to look at the evidence and to prefer the charges, sir. They did the Article 32 investigation into the additional charge. Had the defense objected, they would have had to do a new Article 32 with respect to the old charges, because, again, Article 32, Charlie lets them use it unless there's an objection. In this case, the defense didn't object. Possibly for strategic reasons, it might have been a very valid reason. That would, again, provide protection, sir, and then the opportunity for the convening authority to look at the evidence and to determine where he wanted to send that case, if anywhere. And in this case, he looked at the defense's submissions, he looked at the evidence, and referred it to a general court-martial. Those are the protections that he has. And, of course, the Article 120 clock would start anew at the time of the dismissal, and the government has to then proceed to trial within 120 days, as required under the RCMs, 120 days without excludable delay, of course. With respect to 601 Echo 2, sir, as this was raised, I would point this court again to Hayward, which in that case looked at the effect of 601 Echo 2. And in Hayward, the charges, two 112 alpha charges, one was referred, and it was referred to trial, and the accused was arraigned, and they wanted to add a second 112 alpha charge, and the government did so. And there was no consent by the accused. He just didn't say anything at all. So the record was silent on that. And this court looked to test for substantial prejudice, material prejudice to a substantial right in that case. They did not say that's a jurisdictional error. They did not say that that's a constitutional violation or a statutory violation. When 601 Echo 2 in Haywood was violated, they said non-jurisdictional. And in that case, they actually affirmed and they allowed the conviction to stand for both charges. In this case, the government did not want to violate 601 Echo 2. So instead, they took legitimate actions under the rules to withdraw and dismiss the charges, or to dismiss the charges and start anew. And because they did so, the appellant was protected by the process. He was protected by the assignment of a neutral person to look at the charges, to investigate, and to refer anew. And there was no bad faith on the part of the government here to avoid a speedy trial violation or to avoid a ruling by the military judge they did not like, or to get a military judge they did like. And because of that, Your Honors, because there's no bad faith, and because the government took legitimate and clear steps to dismiss, there is no error. And the dismissal reset the speedy trial clock, and therefore the accused was brought to trial within 50 days after the referral of charges in the second case. Sir, unless there's no further questions, the United States asks this court to affirm the findings and sentence.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant has the opportunity for a rebuttal.
Thank you, members of the court. Judge Stuckey, I'd like to first go back to the question that you last asked me as to the pre versus post arraignment. Direct the court's attention to RCM 604 and the discussion therein. Immediately underneath it says, charges which are withdrawn from a court martial should be dismissed unless it is intended to refer them anew promptly or forward them to another convening authority for disposition. And Chief Judge Baker, to respond to your earlier question, the charges were referred by the same convening authority to the same court martial. Your Honors, with all due respect to my government counsel, I believe that the government is making the same mistake that the Court of Criminal Appeals made below, which is that they are conflating and confusing the terms withdrawal and dismissal. That is certainly understandable given the action of the convening authority, but it is important to remember that they are separate and distinct items.
Is it your position that they can't, that both actions can't take place with respect to a specification and charge?
Oh, I think they can be, Judge, but once you do so, you have to take the proper actions for the dismissal of charges, not for the withdrawal of charges, because...
So in your view, what actions needed to be taken that weren't taken?
Well, a new 32.
Okay, but you don't disagree that under Article 32C, if there's no objection, that they were not, in fact, required to do a new 32.
Well, there was no reason for the defense to object in this case because the charges had been closed, had been withdrawn in the defense's view, not dismissed. So there would have been no reason for the defense to object because there was no dismissal.
They would have known at the time of the referral and the referral, right, when they were served with the second charge sheet.
Judge, I would agree.
Okay, so what else were they required to do that they
did
not do?
The other factors, as listed in Britain,
asking what should they have done that they didn't.
I'm applying them to this case, Judge. They would have lifted his restriction because if you take the government's argument is that the second restriction, quote unquote, is as a result of the second charge. Well, that would mean de facto that the concerns that were
missing. Finish the list?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. They would have, daggummit, Judge, I had my list here, ready and waiting for you. There would have been a period of time for the convening authority to withdraw, to review the charges and to take, to take subsequent action and to take matters under advisement. In this case, it was one continuum. And I think the important thing, Judge, is not what they didn't do, but it's what they did do. And what they did do is they treated these charges as they were the original charges and as if this were a withdrawal because it was one continuing course of action. It's what they didn't do more so than what they did.
But it seems like that was in part because the appellant wasn't objecting.
Well, Judge, again, I don't think the appellant has to object to the withdrawal or to the new 32 when there was a withdrawal, and certainly that is, while that is one of the factors that this court can consider, it's certainly not determinative.
And you contest that the second restriction was on account of LS? So the military judge's finding there was clearly erroneous?
Well, there was clearly erroneous. There's no substance, there's no factual support for it in the record. And if one takes it at its logical extreme, one would say, well, therefore, the government was no longer concerned about the first victim in Idaho because this new restriction only pertained to the second victim. And that simply would not make any sense that any threat to victim one as a result of the appellant's not being under, having his liberty restricted, was no longer in existence just magically on the day of the re-referral of charges.
Do you agree or disagree with this statement, counsel, that it is that it could be, and I'm not asking to say it was in this case, but it could be proper to withdraw and dismiss a charge without prejudice, knowing that you're going to refer those old charges to a new court-martial with additional charges?
If we're speaking pre-arraignment, my answer would be it could be. If we are speaking post-arraignment, my answer is it cannot be.
So a charge can never be withdrawn and dismissed with an intent to add additional charges and forward them collectively to the same court-martial post-arraignment?
Not as I read the rules, Judge. So, Your Honors, based on all of these factors, the violation of the speedy trial clock and the improper, quote, joinder, unquote, of the additional charges to a non-existent set of charges, the appellant requests that this court dismiss the charges. Thank you, Madam Court.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel, and we stand in recess until further order of the court.
Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.